Welcome back to the program. Arthur C. Clarke said that any sufficiently advanced technology should be indistinguishable from magic. This should be true not only for mechanized technology, but for intellectual technology as well. For the process of putting out a great daily newspaper is arguably such a process, especially today, given the torrent of information, of news, and of individual bits and bytes that are coming at us every minute of every day. The ability to aggregate it, to cull it, fact-check it, put it into a narrative form, and make sure it arrives on your doorstep each morning is truly a feat of magic. There may be more efficient ways of doing it today. Maybe we can do it without the trucks and without the dead trees. But the process of creating great narrative journalism in high-quality, general-interest newspapers is unquestionably unique. This process is at the heart of a new documentary and its companion volume, Taking a Look at the New York Times. Amidst a landscape of technological revolution, information overload, shrinking ad revenues, political polarization, and institutional distrust, the Times, and by extension journalism, struggle to survive. This morning we're joined by David Folkenflik. He's the media correspondent for NPR News, and he's the editor of the companion volume Page One, A Look Inside the New York Times and the Future of Journalism. David Folkenflik, thanks so much for joining us.
Hey, thanks so much for having me, Jeff.
Great to have you here. You know, one of the things we've seen over the years is dramatic transformation in so many media-related industries. The music business certainly has changed, the movie business, publishing, etc. Newspapers have had a particularly difficult time of it for so many reasons. Talk a little about that and some of the contributors to this volume who have really gotten to the heart of the problems newspapers have faced different from some of the other media.
Well, I am speaking to you as, I guess, a recovering newspaper man myself. I worked for newspapers in Carolinas and in particularly in Baltimore for 14 so years. Newspapers have been beset by a number of problems, many of them of their own making. There have been the elements that they simply didn't foresee about the way technological shifts would siphon off revenue that they took for granted. They took for granted things like classified ads, the car ads. They took for granted real estate ads. They took for granted the smaller classified ads that Craigslist just took away just by making it free. People can search for their cars, their homes, things they want to buy online for themselves. It's disaggregated, shall we say, the revenue streams of the classifieds, those thick real estate and car sections you used to see a decade or two ago in major papers, from subsidizing the newsroom. Second thing, of course, is the economy. That's affected a lot of newspapers in a big way. Surprisingly, and until I really got into the meat of this, I didn't realize how much the consolidation in department stores, in not just cars, but department stores and telephone companies were two big advertisers. Well, when they were, you know, 6, 7, 8, 9 different major chains or companies that were competing, they would take out major ads. When there are 2 or 3, they don't need to advertise as much, and even when they do, they don't need to blanket the world with advertising. So it's a those were significant revenue losses. In addition, people now no longer have to rely on what is able to be delivered to their doorstep. I'm from Southern California. I used to rely on my mom and dad sending me clippings about the Angels mm-hmm. and baseball scores 2-3 days later. You know, I might be able to find the next day somewhere an East Coast paper that had a late score here or there, but most of the time I wanted to see how things were going. Well, every morning I checked the LA Times sports page on my iPhone right now, and it's exceptionally convenient. It's instantaneous. Well, you know, people aren't willing to pay for the print edition, and as a result, advertisers aren't having to pay as much. They're not reaching as many readers. The funny thing, however, is that advertisers are not giving news organizations as much credit for reaching online readers the same pair of eyeballs as they do in print. So you might get a dime to the dollar for the digital eyeballs as for the print subscriber. And that means that even as news organizations are actually having expanding readership as you take into account their digital audience, they're seeing a yet another major compression of their finances. The last thing I'll add is there was a lot of greed in the industry. People took expanding revenues for granted. Even well-run news companies like Knight Ridder, which used to have a lot of papers in the Bay Area, now, as I understand, sort of carved out between Media News and McClatchy. you know, even Knight Ridder assumed that it would have expanding double-digit profits year after year after year, and therefore, on the one hand, they were taking money to profits rather than reinvesting and reinventing. And on the other hand, there was a drive to figure out ways that executives and media companies, just as executives in oil companies, financial companies, other companies, were not looking out for their stakeholders, but looking out for themselves. So the Tribune Company, for example, is now broke. And part of that is the media climate, but a lot of that is the fact that in two different deals, in 2000 when Tribune took over Times Mirror and the LA Times Company, and also again in 2007 when it was taken over by the real estate investor Sam Zell, he really saw this as a chance to make a lot of money without investing a lot of money. And what they did was pile up ultimately $13 billion of debt on a company that was at the time valued at $7 billion. Right now it's in, you know, Delaware bankruptcy court.
It is interesting when you go a little deeper on this that there was this traditional disconnect between where the revenues came from and what the ultimate product of journalism was. And in that disconnect and lack of business clarity on the part of so many lies a lot of the problem. I mean, you see it in the documentary and in Jim O'Shea's piece in your book, talking about the almost welcoming attitude initially towards Sam Zell taking over the Tribune, thinking, well, maybe they understand it. Maybe they have a business model, a business plan that'll work. And, of course, as you say, it didn't work at all.
Yeah, I mean, I think people looked forward to Sam Zell just because he thought that there was a way to make money off news organizations. And they thought, geez, the jokers who have been running us for the last 10 years, they don't have the answers.
Right.
They're cashing out. You know, they took 40-some-plus million dollars of bonuses as part of that sale to Sam Zell. They said, good riddance to those guys. Here's somebody with energy. Well, he was somebody with energy. He invested a few hundred million dollars of his own money to get a 40% stake in that, you know, company valued at something like $7.8 billion at the time of the sale. And what he really did was sought to wring out additional costs. And then he said in order to, on the creative side of the ledger, he brought in a guy named Randy Michaels who had had some success in building up radio stations, commercial music radio stations, a kind of shock jock guy with a shock jock sensibility. David Carr's expose in the Times about his behavior and as written about more thoroughly by Jim O'Shea in his book, which we excerpted in the chapter called The Deal from Hell in our book, you know, really documented that his notion was, this is our playground. And so, you know, let's have fun. Let's not worry so much about Baghdad. You know, we can have people in Baghdad. We can have people in Washington. We don't have to have as many people as we had. And there's a legitimate argument about that. Nonetheless, there's also a sense that there was, you know, a real gutting of some proud newspapers. You're talking about the LA Times, the Chicago Tribune, my old paper, the Baltimore Sun, the Hartford Courant. These are distinguished papers that match up with any four other, you know, major papers in the country. And, you know, they now stand at, you know, my old newsroom used to have something like 408, 410 journalists. It now has something over 220, 230.
Right. One of the other aspects of this is losing sight of what great newspapers do. Matt Thompson, your colleague at NPR, gets to the heart of this in his piece in the book. Really, the job of newspapers in terms of interpretation, and not to get too caught up in just the new part of news.
That's right. If you think about this, I just did a profile that ran last week about Mark Whitaker, who's the new chief of news for CNN and its networks. And he comes over after spending a generation at Newsweek. One of the challenges at Newsweek was that Newsweek saw its space usurped by major newspapers like the New York Times, the Washington Post, and the Wall Street Journal, because every day major newspapers were putting out effectively news magazines that provided you not only with what happened, but why happened. What does it mean happened, and what's about to happen? And that used to be sort of the analytic and interpretive space of Newsweek and Time, and I think really contributed with the decline of those titles, which have struggled to figure out what their role is, given that they're not journals of opinion. Well, the funny thing was, in talking with Mark about his challenge at CNN, is that he says it's basically the same thing. I mean, you think of 24/7 cable news as being up to the second, you know, all those flashing chyrons that can change in the moment and instant live shots and all that. But he says, look, even when, by the time we get things on the air, from Yahoo News, from Twitter, from Facebook, you're already learning what the headline is. Somebody's shot. An airline's gone down. There's been an earthquake in Japan. So it's now up to even the what we thought of as an instant communication of live cable news to be a little bit more enterprising, investigative, analytic, and really talk about the why, the what, and the how, rather than simply the what just happened. And I think that's what Matt's getting at with his, I think, very thoughtful, very provocative essay about leaving the tyranny of the new behind in interpreting what the news now means, a distinction between news and a headline.
It's interesting. In the documentary, even when there is this talk about this publication Vice, the guy from the publication talks about that they're there to tell stories. Even the alternative press understands that it's about telling stories, not just relating what's new.
That's right. I mean, they've got a, you know, it's almost become a cliche, but it was rather, until rather recently, a real insight, the notion that news has become a commodity. The specific facts, the broken down data points, are available anywhere. I take an elevator up to the NPR's bureau here on the 19th floor, overlooking Bryant Park in Midtown Manhattan, and there's something called Captivate, which is a little terminal in our elevator that delivers little two-sentence headlines, news updates about what's happening around the world. I can get my news off that. I get into a cab in New York, and they've got a little live broadcast of NBC's local affiliate here in New York that tells you the morning's headlines. So you're getting news all over the place. The question is, where are you getting value? The funny thing is, so many news executives I talk to, and this is unprompted. It's not like I'm pushing them on this, but so many of them bring up the NPR model, saying you know, we already have the space of being able to tell you not only what happened, but what's behind the headlines. There are people who have pushed internally at NPR for us to get a little crisper at telling you the headlines, being a little bit more up to the moment and being a little bit more competitive on the story. And I think in the last decade, you've really seen that happen. But that's an interesting debate about where you define the news and where you define its velocity and its metabolism.
The other part of it, of course, is what people are willing to pay for, what they're in the habit of getting for free, and whether or not within the new technology there's any way to change that.
That's right. I mean, you see right now at the New York Times, the nation's leading newspaper, you know, which has had its own financial troubles but has weathered many of them for the last few years decently. It's implemented this spring a paywall. It's not a firm paywall. You can access about half dozen stories for free, I think five stories for free, each month until you come up to a wall that says, hey, you got to pay. Now, there are little ways around that. If somebody emails you a link, if you see a tweet about it that includes a link and you click on that, it won't be counted against you. That won't push you over. The heaviest users are going to be required to pay. Now, again, there's a little bit of a public radio mentality, or at least there's the effort to portray it in that way. They say, you know, we only need a small percentage of our readers to pay for it. Public radio has built up to the point where about 10% of its listenership, its most avid listenership, does voluntarily give. The Times is saying, look, we hope to have that kind of brand loyalty to build up to that. I pointed out that, you know, it took years, decades, really, to build up this model in such a way where all the legs of the stool works, the different revenue streams, but listeners obviously being one of the primary and most important one, especially for our stations. But they are trying to see if they can show themselves to be of great enough value that people voluntarily pay, even given that they can go for free to the Washington Post or the LA Times websites, to Politico or to you know, local sports blogs to get all kinds of other information. It's been doable with things like the Wall Street Journal, which provides financial information. It's considered to have one of the most successful pay sites in the U.S. The financial information is seen as giving people a business edge. They're willing to pay for it, and they can write it off on their business expenses. Other people are willing to pay for certain kinds of proprietary sports information about incredible passions. But the Times is taking a gamble that they say, look, we think that we provide it on a high enough end that people want that for general interest news and cultural coverage.
Right. I mean, general interest is really the key. People have been willing to pay for specific things, business news, sports news, technology news, etc. It's really been the general interest area where it's been so tough.
That's exactly right.
Talk a little bit about why you think that journalism in general, newspapers, didn't see this coming.
I think that they were fat with profits. I think they were arrogant. I think they felt in their lifetimes this is the way it had always been. You know, there was sort of a 75-year stretch where major newspapers either had monopolies or near monopolies. You saw a lot of afternoon papers go out of business. You saw that in the Bay Area. More recently, you saw that in Seattle and in Denver. The Rocky Mountain News is no more. But both of those cities still have major, you know, daily papers that are actually, if anything, stronger by the loss of the second papers in the market. Mm-hmm. They just thought, you know, we're always going to have real estate ads, we're always going to have classifieds, we're always going to be a place that people come to for their coupons. You know, they never thought of Groupon providing coupons directly. They never thought of Craigslist offering listings for free, because what business model is that? You know, they thought that they would always have this near monopolistic hold on people's attention, and the you know, there was always concern about younger people, younger generations being brought up on television and then being brought up with this new web technology. But they thought, you know, once they have kids, once they buy houses, once their kids start going to schools, they will be forced to be perhaps more civically oriented and therefore more invested in what happens in their communities. And that always leads to subscriptions to print newspapers. And, you know, subscription to print newspapers is by far the best way for them to get it revenue, the newspapers, and the best way to, you know, prop up those advertising rates. Well, all of that has been cast not only into doubt, but cast asunder. None of that has really held up, and newspapers are casting about to be leaner, to be more nimble, to be more aware of their audience, because suddenly they realize that people aren't paying for their wonderful news. They're often paying for the advertising, and when the advertising goes away, a lot of people go away with it.
It's not dissimilar from the way younger people adjusted to the music business. They suddenly didn't want to pay for music and now are having to be reacclimated to that.
Yeah, and I'm a little more agnostic than some people about the notion of whether something like the Times paywall can work. And believe me, even the Times' most bitter rivals are hoping that the paywall works fundamentally, because they'd like to use it too.
Well, you know, there was a story yesterday that somewhere that 2% of web traffic today is from tablets. And that really is, you know, the iPad and such. I mean, that's really the second chance for the newspaper industry.
They certainly hope so, and it seems more likely. I must say that if you look at the Murdoch experiment of the Daily, which is a tablet-only publication, that you can kind of get to it online, but it's not intended to be read that way. I would say that that has not been a huge success. If you look at the Times of London, I went to London in December to do a story, and they've really pushed hard on their tablet applications. They have a firm paywall there at the Times of London. You basically, I think you get a week or so free, and then you have to pay for anything you get. It's not hugely expensive. It's a pound, I think, a week, or, you know, £40 for the year. But, you know, their traffic dropped off from 20 million unique visitors a month to about 55, 54,000 paying monthly subscribers. Now, I don't know what the updated data was, because they were holding it very close to the vest. But all of that suggests that, you know, there are real consequences depending on how you design the paywall. If you make it leaky enough, you know, you can not have it nearly as brutal a drop-off in traffic. But if you make it leaky enough, you may not get enough money to make it worthwhile. It's expensive to implement these things.
Finally, there really seem to be two parallel stories going on here. One, the story of the business model, which you and I have just been talking about. And two, the other part of the story, which is how important these general interest newspapers are to a functioning democracy.
Well, you know, I got to say this. Newspapers have had the greatest horsepower in journalism, period, in America, just period. They are still far and away the largest news organizations in most communities. They generate the most stories. They are, you know, a lot of stories in any given community are derived from the headlines generated from newspapers. So there was a study done by Pew in Baltimore, my old city, a year or two back, and it found that I think it was the overwhelming majority of news stories were generated by the Sun, even though its ranks had been, you know, vastly depleted from what they were just a decade ago. You know, newspapers typically drive the news cycle. That said, I think it's important to note that there are a lot of new actors in play. There are a lot of, you know, there's the Huffington Post or Andrew Breitbart on the, you know, the left and the right, you know, respectively. There are public media outlets, including our own, which are filling the gap left by a lot of the cuts. So you're seeing a lot of enterprise journalism done by not-for-profits, whether it's NPR and its member stations, or whether it's new ones jumping up, like the Texas Tribune. Evan Smith, its editor-in-chief, wrote a chapter about how it was working in Texas and also how news organizations were collaborating. So you might have a public radio station in Austin collaborate with the Texas Tribune, the new not-for-profit down there, or several for-profit newspapers collaborate with his outfit to do more investigative work that might have once been the providence solely of big newspapers.
David Folkenflik, he's the media correspondent for NPR News and the editor of the companion volume to the documentary Page One, entitled Page One, Inside the New York Times and the Future of Journalism. It's just out from Public Affairs. David, thanks so much for spending time with us.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.